Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Monday, January 23rd, 2023. And today in history, January 23rd, 1737, John Hancock was born. We all know him for that big signature on the Declaration of Independence, but it was no accident that he was the president of the Second Continental Congress. So on this episode, I want to share some highlights. We don't get a lot of history about John Hancock. He really is a forgotten founder in many ways. And I'm going to talk about that as early as 1809. He was starting to be forgotten as well. So I want to share a little bit about one of the most important of the old revolutionaries, going all the way back to the Stamp Act in 1765. And then through his influence on ratification of the Constitution, which may not have happened without his approach. Thomas Jefferson thought it was a great approach, and specifically his support for a precursor to what became the 10th Amendment. But first of all, before getting to that, a quick hello, a huge thank you. Thank you so much for being here, whether this is your first episode or you've been here for every single one since day one. Thank you so much. While we allow people another minute or so to get notifications to join us on the live stream platforms, I want to take a little time and say hello to everyone out in the live chat. I've done actually some changes in our stream settings, our encoding and transcoding and audio settings. I know over at odyssey.com, we've been having some difficulties with the stream quality and stream actually working over there. So we're going to find out if we can get this thing solved from my amateur brain on this. Anyways, hi to that Liberty Gal in DFW. Good to see you. Garrett Ashley, Cheriton Farmer, Alt Reality, Tyler BM, Gabriel, a lot of Missouri representing. Appreciate you guys. Haji in Southeast Michigan, we love you from everywhere, but lots of Missouri lately. Clay Kent, AM in Michigan, Israel, Douglas Fox, Sharon Patriot, Senator DT, Dave Simmons, Burning Rubber, that's pretty awesome, and everyone else. Sharon Patriot says, smash the like button, you got that right. It does help trigger the algorithm of the platforms you may watch or listen on and tells them to show us to more people, and that helps out a ton. And let's get right to this. I know I skipped over a few people, but I will do my best if we have some time to get back to some comments or questions later in the show, or you can leave me comments in the archive, which also helps trigger the algorithm, and I can get back to those later. I get a lot of great ideas for future episodes from your feedback. This is an awesome community. Anyways, I should also mention that 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. You got to follow us over there if you want to follow along with all the original source documents and articles and stuff that I'm going to be mentioning here. There is a blog post that I publish 1 to 2 hours after the live stream is done. And there's a show link section where you can just, Bolden, where's that link? You mentioned that amnesty where they were going after John Hancock. And I want to be able to read that myself. So you will find that over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. And speaking of that reference that I'm making there, about 2 months after the fighting broke out in Lexington and Concord in 1775. So this is June 12th, 1775. General Gage made an offer of amnesty. Basically, well, let me just read it to you here, if I can pull up my notes. He said, I do hereby, in His Majesty's name, offer and promise His most gracious pardon to all persons who shall forthwith lay down their arms and return to their duties of peaceable subjects. So there was a peace offering from General Gage on June 12, 1775, just under 2 months after the fighting was really starting to take off. And he's like, let's get back to peace here. But there was a little caveat to that. Anybody who laid down their arms and stopped fighting, amnesty, total pardon, accepting only from the benefit of such pardon, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, whose offenses are of too flagitious a nature, too bad, I guess we'll put it in context there, to admit of any other consideration than that of condign punishment. In short, give up your guns and give up your friends, and we won't kill you. Now, of course, the colonists didn't take too kindly to this, and John Hancock was president of the Continental Congress. I believe this was Second Continental Congress at that time. And in response, just a couple of weeks after that, they passed unanimously what was called the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms. It was co-authored by Thomas Jefferson and John Dickinson. In essence, we could call this almost a Declaration of Independence. It was not what they weren't actually claiming independence, but they were saying why they were fighting. And at one point, they said, we shouldn't even list all of our injuries in detail because by one thing that you guys are doing, you claim the power over us in all cases whatsoever. And Hancock talked about that as well, and I'm going to get to that later in the episode. But here's how they summed it up. This was the response to give up your guns, give up your friends, and we'll give you peace. In other words, sell out, right? In our own native land, in defense of the freedom that is our birthright, they talked about natural rights, our freedom, our birthright, and which we ever enjoyed till the late violation of it, for the protection of our property, acquired solely by the honest industry of our forefathers and ourselves, against violence actually offered, we have taken up arms. So we're protecting our freedom in our homeland, our natural rights, our property acquired by our hard work. We have had to take up arms in response to you using violence against us. Of course, that was a gun control program. They were going to get gunpowder and the like at Lexington and Concord. They said, we shall lay them down when hostilities shall cease on the part of the aggressors, and all danger of their being renewed shall be removed and not before. In other words, we're going to continue fighting back until we have decided that you are no longer a threat. And we don't care if you offer us peace and tell us to give up John Hancock and Samuel Adams. We're not going to do that. So anyways, as I started learning this history, because so much of what I do in our work here at the 10th Amendment Center, really, you can trace the lineage of the 10th Amendment, power actually coming from the people and having sovereign authority, and how to deal with power when it goes beyond its limits, goes back to the American Revolution. The revolution being a revolution in thought, in the change, a radical change in the principles and viewpoints of the people. And so as I started learning this history, knowing that General Gage was basically saying, okay, lay down your arms, pardon for everybody, but Hancock and Adams, that really made me like both of those dudes quite a bit. That's kind of all I needed. But when it comes to Samuel Adams, you can find tons of history. John Hancock, on the other hand, it's not easy to find stuff. And I've been digging into this 4 years. There weren't any full-length books on him for almost 150 years. And as early as 1809, I've got a letter from John Adams here written to Joseph Ward in 1809. He was actually lamenting that Hancock and Adams both were being ignored by the people of that time so soon after the revolution itself. And here's how Adams put it. There appears to me to be a very extraordinary and unaccountable inattention in our countrymen to the history of their own country. We can love or hate John Adams. We can look at him as just as the Atlas of Independence, one of the best before the War for Independence, or what Mercy Otis Warren lamented about him years after ratification, that once he got in power, he was kind of a monarchist, he was a bad guy. But when it comes to this particular statement, he's absolutely correct. He's, you know, if you don't pay attention to your history, if you don't learn from who you came and where you started, what do you have to build on? You don't have a good foundation. He was lamenting. He says, there is an unaccountable inattention to our countrymen to the history of their own country. And we have that today, without a doubt. While every kind of trifle from Europe is printed and scattered profusely in America, our own original historians are very much neglected. And he goes on, he said, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, in particular, are almost buried in oblivion. That was in 1809. He was concerned that these great revolutionaries, these influential people, they were so influential. Both of those two were influential on what became the 10th Amendment as well. I'll get to that later. Now, there was a challenge for historians when it comes to Hancock, for example. Adams, not nearly as much. But here at Wikipedia, that's actually a pretty good overview. They say no full-length biography of Hancock appeared until the 20th century. A challenge facing Hancock biographers is that compared to prominent founders like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, Hancock left relatively few personal writings for historians to use in interpreting his life. He didn't do a lot of speeches. He didn't do a lot of essays or writing. I mean, of course, there's a bunch of stuff even on Samuel Adams, who wasn't a prolific writer as well, not like someone like Jefferson, who was kind of writing for posterity. Adams, his letters, the Adams family... No pun intended there. Anyways, there are papers. There's tons of it, volumes of this stuff. Anyways, going further, they say, as a result, most depictions of Hancock have relied on the voluminous writings of his political opponents. And that's why almost every time you hear about Hancock today, a lot of times it's peppered with, oh, he only did this because he was rich and he didn't like the taxation regime and he was always self-motivated, even though he was risking all of his fortune to stand against the empire. We don't hear that. But his opponents wanted to paint him in a bad light, bad motives, as being somebody that wasn't in touch with the people, but the people loved him. Anyways, many of the modern depictions of him, and I see this most of the time still today, have relied on the writings of his opponents, who are often scathingly critical of him. And I thought that was an interesting piece of insight that actually made it into Wikipedia and State. But anyway, so I want to give you a little propaganda in the other direction instead. Now, he was born, I think it was about 8 months after Patrick Henry. And these two were just under 30 years old when the Stamp Act was set to go into effect in 1765. Patrick Henry really lit a spark that helped launch much of the resistance through his passage of the, well, not even passage, his drafting of the Virginia Resolves, calling for resistance and disobedience to it. And then Hancock started a little bit more moderate, but working with Samuel Adams, he was kind of under Adams's wing at that point. He quickly came around, and this was a letter that he sent to his London agent, Jonathan Bernard, weeks before the Stamp Act was supposed to go into effect. And this is a message that I think we need far more of today, and not just in a tax of a few percent. Well, maybe if we can get rid of all the other stuff, then we could focus on stuff like that as well. But anyways, the people of this country will never be made slaves of by a submission to the damned act. Submitting to something is what establishes what John Dickinson, weeks before this, called the detestable precedent. So as soon as you comply with something, government has no reason to get rid of it. And the people of the time, Hancock was really summing up the spirit of the time in that letter. He recognized that noncompliance and resistance was the only way to get rid of the damned act. And there's so many of those on the books as well. Also, there's the Townshend Acts of 1767. And let me read this again. Interesting overview, and maybe sometimes you can get some decent stuff over at Wiki, but they say over on April 9th, 1768, Townshend Act was 1767. Dickinson's letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania were drafted or written in late 1767. He sent them over to Samuel Adams and James Otis Jr. and said, do something with this in early 1768 in Massachusetts. And of course, they all worked very closely with Hancock. And Hancock was not on board with complying with the Townshend Acts as well. And so on April 9th, 1768, two customs employees called tidesmen boarded his brig Lydia in Boston Harbor. Hancock was summoned, and finding that the agents lacked a writ of assistance, even a general search warrant, he did not allow them to go below deck. So, hey, can I see? He said, can I see your papers, please, to the government people? And said, you aren't allowed on board. They still pushed their way in, and I'm not sure how they did it, but there was a kind of a standoff at that point, but they say when one of them later managed to get into the hold, Hancock's men, on his orders, they forced them off and back on deck. So they were willing to take a stand. And they wanted to file charges. They didn't actually do that. Maybe it was a political reason because he was so popular and also powerful and rich, but I'm not sure. The AG at the time said no law was broken because they didn't have this writ, and it's okay for them to actually push back on the law enforcement people who are trying to come in, but Hancock was willing to do this. And later on, some of Hancock's most ardent admirers called this incident the first act of physical resistance to British authority in the colonies, and they also credit him with initiating the American Revolution. I don't actually subscribe to that. I think, like John Adams or Thomas Jefferson said, the revolution was really a revolution in thought, and that you could either ascribe that, the beginning of that, to James Otis Jr., his speech against the writs of assistance in 1761, or as Thomas Jefferson put it, the passage of the Stamp Act, the Sugar Act to the Stamp Act, and also Patrick Henry's response to that. But this is certainly a physical stand against the British here by John Hancock, a very young man, and had a lot to risk by doing that rather than simply complying. That also led to something called the Liberty Affair, where we kind of get the mythology of John Hancock, which we can't verify, that he was the greatest smuggler of his time, certainly trying to undermine the British mercantilist trade policies. And he had a ship called the Liberty. Now, there's no records of him being a smuggler, so either there's no actual hard evidence of this at all, but either he was really good at it or it's kind of overblown. I don't know. I kind of want to have the view that he was the great smuggler that we think he is. But there's an interesting article. I'm going to link to two of them, not really highlight any of them right now, but the New England Historical Society called The Liberty Affair, John Hancock Loses a Ship and Starts a Riot. He was so popular, they took his ship. And they started using his ship, so basically asset forfeiture. They took his ship without convicting him. They said he was probably guilty, so they took him, and then they put him on trial. They used his ship to enforce some of the trade regulations and trade rules and taxation. People in Rhode Island rioted, boarded the ship, burned it down. So it's a pretty interesting history that I will link to so you can read on your own time. And there's also how John Adams won the Hancock trial from the great Journal of the American Revolution. So this is really interesting stuff, but I'm not going to get into all the details on that. So anyways, we also, moving forward to 1770, we have the massacre in Boston. Hancock was not involved in that specifically or personally, but he personally led a committee that demanded removal of the troops after. And it wasn't just the kind of normal kind of demand, like, hey, you guys better do this or we're going to do some petitions. Hancock actually went to the governor and he said, this is Governor Hutchinson at this point, and he actually said, if you guys don't take the troops out of here after this, I'm going to assemble 10,000 armed colonists and march them on Boston. So he basically was, once again, like he did in 1768, he was willing to draw a line in the sand and say, no way, I don't care. There's a principle at hand here, and we have to take a stand for it. Now, I think he was probably bluffing, and I don't think there were 10,000 armed citizens ready to roll and march. And I don't think Hutchison, at least from my reading of the history, I don't think the governor thought that it was real as well, for sure, but it still worked. And he was considered a hero for negotiating or pressuring the British to moving the troops out at least for a little bit. And there was a time of calm at some point. And so I don't think, if you think about these types of things, I don't think we need to wonder why General Gage had an exemption in his amnesty offer for people like Samuel Adams, who I'm not really talking about today, but also John Hancock, because he was so willing to put his neck on the line. In 1774, Hancock was also the guy that was named to give the annual Massacre Day oration. In Boston, it was kind of a solemn public event every single year after 1770 for a number of years, where they would all gather together and they would remember. And there would be a keynote speaker, like a conference, talking about what was going on, what had to be done. And Hancock's turn was in 1774. And you get this great quote from that one where he said, "I glory in publicly avowing my eternal enmity to tyranny." He wasn't a guy that was just going to do the work behind the scenes, maybe pay for some stuff, maybe come up with some strategy. He was making himself at the forefront, even though he had so much to lose. A lot of times, the people with the greatest wealth, the ones that do the great work, are the ones that help fund stuff, but they're not on the front line saying, you know what, hey, Governor Hutchison, if you don't do this, I'm going to march people in here. They could have arrested him on the spot for that. But instead, it was he leveraged that and pushed forward. Now, he reminded people in that speech that the revolution, even though we're taught this all the time today, that the revolution was really just about taxation without representation. That is propaganda. It was not a tax revolution. Hancock taught us exactly what it was about. We learned the same from people like Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. It was about unlimited centralized power. And he said, they have declared that they have ever had and of right ought ever to have full power to make laws of sufficient validity to bind the colonies in all cases whatsoever. Again, all cases whatsoever was the problem. And that's what he's reminding the people of Boston there, who suffered the massacre in 1770. No one disagreed with this. And how did they do that? He said, they have exercised this pretended right by imposing a tax upon us without our consent. So taxation without representation was just one example of the British under the Declaratory Act of 1766 claiming power over the British, and it was in the British law that said they had power over them in all cases whatsoever. And he's saying, like, look, this is one of the things that they've done, but the underlying issue is that they are claiming this unlimited power over us. And he also said this, and he wanted everyone to focus. We may have some differences, and there certainly were, and you could see how that changed or how those differences really widened after ratification or during the ratification debates. But he said, we have all one common cause. Let it therefore be our only contest. Who shall most contribute to the security of the liberties of America? That, again, was his massacre day oration, March 5th, 1774. I covered that speech in full detail in its own episode back in March of 2021, remembering Boston Massacre Day. They didn't call it Boston Massacre. They just called it the Massacre Day. This was the John Hancock edition. I will link to that episode in the show notes. It's one of my favorite kind of history lessons that I've done. Now, I think at the time when I was prepping that, I still thought, because the speech was so powerful and so awesome, I was like, maybe Hancock, and he ended up being governor and he was really well known. Maybe he was a great writer and a great speaker and we just are missing all the papers. But I think what I've learned over the last few years is that he really wasn't known as a great writer. We know that Joseph Warren, Samuel Adams certainly contributed at least a half, if not two-thirds of the writing of this. They worked with him very closely. And I don't think he was known as a really powerful speaker in public. Thomas Jefferson certainly was a terrible one as well. But John Adams thought he did an amazing job. And here in his diary of that night, March 5th, 1774, he said, I heard the oration pronounced by Colonel Hancock in commemoration of the massacre. The composition, the pronunciation, the action all exceeded the expectations of everybody. They exceeded even mine, which were very considerable. Many of the sentiments came with great propriety from him. So he thought he did an amazing job, and everyone was kind of skeptical, at least kind of the bigwigs in the independence movement, the Patriots. They were concerned that Hancock, maybe he wasn't going to do an awesome job, but Adams thought he did amazing. He said his invective, particularly against a preference of riches to virtue, came from him with singular dignity and grace. So in other words, hey, don't just go and support people because they're rich. Follow the people who are doing the right moral thing. And that's coming from the rich guy who's saying, no, I'm not doing the right thing because I have loot. We all have to have the common cause of advancing liberty. That was from John Adams's diary. And now later that year, under the Coercive Acts, this is another reason why I think he was exempted from that amnesty offer. But later in 1774, Governor Thomas Gage dissolved the Provincial Assembly under the terms of the Government Act. This is the Coercive Acts, what most people today call the Intolerable Acts. But in Massachusetts, even though they dissolved the assembly, they ignored him. And the 90 elected representatives met as scheduled in Salem anyways. He shut down the representation of the people and they said, okay, you may say that, but we're going to do it anyways. They reconvened in Concord and organized itself into the Massachusetts Provisional Congress. And John Hancock was elected as president of this de facto illegal government of the people. They quickly became the de facto government of Massachusetts outside Boston, writes Mike Meharry. I will link to his really interesting article on this in the show notes. But 2 weeks later, the Provisional Congress, with John Hancock as president, they passed a resolution directing constables and tax collectors to do what? withhold funds from the British government. So it's already a tax protest in 1774. And if you want to piss off the empire, whether it was the British Empire of them or the Empire of Washington, D.C. today, which is an empire over the world and the states equally, doing stuff it never should be doing, policing things and getting involved in things it was never authorized to do and shouldn't be doing in the first place. If you want to get on their bad side, like John Hancock and Samuel Adams did, you certainly withhold their money. And that's what they were pushing forward for in 1774 in Massachusetts. Anyways, that's some of the most important revolutionary stuff that I wanted to cover. But I also think he's really forgotten for being one of the founding fathers of the 10th Amendment that we have today. And if we jump forward to the time of ratification in October of 1787, just after the Philadelphia Convention was all done, Richard Henry Lee, who was trying to get amendments included in the Continental Congress before it was sent to the states, he failed in that, but he thought it was important. He sent the proposed amendments to his good friend. So Richard Henry Lee in Virginia sent the proposed amendments up to Samuel Adams, who worked very closely with John Hancock. And according to James Sullivan, who I think was the AG under Hancock some years later, he pointed out that Hancock also was drafting amendments before the Massachusetts ratifying convention even started. We know there's some really interesting history on this. We know that Massachusetts was about to vote down the Constitution. And one of the reasons was they wanted a Bill of Rights and they wanted it to be expressly declared that the powers not delegated were going to be reserved to the states and the people. And they were very concerned about a line in the sand between federal and state power, all of which were emanations of power from the people. So Hancock, Samuel Adams, we don't necessarily call them anti-federalists because they ended up making a deal in support, but they were very skeptical. So John Hancock, who had been drafting amendments, Samuel Adams, who had been working with Richard Henry Lee on drafting amendments, they made a deal with people like Theophilus Parsons, probably Rufus King, and a few others to basically say, okay, if you can agree that you will get these, we can recommend amendments from Massachusetts for the federal constitution or the constitution for the United States, then we will go ahead and give a thumbs up to ratification. And that was the deal that was made. It wasn't a conditional one, basically saying we don't ratify unless these amendments are included. It was a gentleman's deal, old school, which they don't hold to ever anymore. But here's the first one on that list. This is February 6, 1788. First, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated by the aforesaid Constitution are reserved but to the several states to be by them exercised. So Hancock, Adams, and others were really on board with what became the 10th Amendment. Thomas Jefferson, in some letters back and forth on this in 1788 and 89, he basically thought, now we often think of Thomas Jefferson as the ultimate 10th Amendment guy because he years later said he considered the foundation of the Constitution to be based on the 10th Amendment itself. But he even himself thought the Hancock edition of this was a little too restrictive. So maybe Hancock was even more of a tenther, and so was Samuel Adams, than even Thomas Jefferson. But this is what they passed. This was the ratification document from Massachusetts, which I will link to in the show notes. Again, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated by the aforesaid Constitution are reserved to the several states to be by them exercise. The full story about that ratification deal in Massachusetts is in one of my favorite history books. I link to the store over at 10th Amendment Center. You can find it cheaper elsewhere for sure. We're not a discount dealer. When you buy something from us, we always get a few extra bucks to continue advancing this kind of message. But ratification, the people debate the Constitution, one of my favorite books by the great Pauline Mayer, who passed away some years ago. But this is really interesting stuff if you want to check out a full-length book. Anyways, here's John Hancock's speech in support of that ratification with those amendments. So on February 5th or 6th, 1788, he basically said, look, this is what we made a deal on. We want to get these amendments. And of course, that first one was what was a precursor of what became the 10th Amendment. And he told the people there in the ratification debate, he said, look, the powers reserved by the people render them secure. Now, it's really up to the people to use that power that have been reserved by them. Here, I thought it was interesting to point out that Thomas Jefferson really liked this approach that Hancock and others went forward with in Massachusetts. At first, he was basically saying, uh-oh, we got to get these amendments in advance. But here in a letter to Edward Carrington, so Jefferson was in Paris at the time, he's writing to Edward Carrington some months after this, so that was February 1788. This is May of 1788. He said, "My first wish was that 9 states would adopt the Constitution in order to ensure what was good in it." He was neither Federalist nor Anti-Federalist, and he liked a lot that was in there, but he wanted to see amendments, particularly a Bill of Rights. And he said the other states, 4 of them, he wanted to hold off and vote no. And that was his strategy. Jefferson was advising this throughout 1788, or at least the early part. "So my first wish was 9 states adopt, and then the others hold off to produce the necessary amendments. But the plan of Massachusetts is far preferable, and will, I hope, be followed by those who are yet to decide." And especially if you think about that, thinking about Virginia, which was also on the very much on the no side of things. But he's basically saying Jefferson gave his seal of approval to John Hancock's approach in Massachusetts, which is, let's make a deal, let's ratify what we have, get this done, and let's get the amendments shortly thereafter. Patrick Henry did not like that approach, but Jefferson was certainly on board. Here he is again the following year, March of 1789, in a letter to Francis Hopkinson. And he says this same thing again a year later. This wasn't just kind of a passing fancy from Jefferson. He said, "My first wish was that the first 9 conventions might accept the Constitution as the means of securing to us the great mass of good it contained, and that the last 4 might reject it as the means of obtaining amendments." He was going to use that as leverage. "But I was corrected in this wish the moment I saw the much better plan of Massachusetts, and which had never even occurred to me." So if you think about it, you know, in the past, I've often referred to people like Patrick Henry as the original Tenther. He was so much against consolidation, centralization of power over and over throughout his career. And if you go all the way back to the Stamp Act, he was also saying, hey, the government, the reason we're drafting these resolves against the Stamp Act is to make it clear that the far-off government can do certain things and other things like this particular tax, the Stamp Act, if it's going to be done, well, that can only be done by our local assembly. And therefore, because they're not authorized to do this, the people are not bound to yield obedience to that. And that was Patrick Henry's approach. So I've often thought of him as the original Tenther because of those foundational principles. But I think John Hancock is also a founding father of the 10th Amendment, using very similar mentality in his resistance or his views opposing the Stamp Act, and personally his resistance to the taxes under the Townsend Act, and then, of course, for his work in getting what became the 10th Amendment included in the recommended amendments by Massachusetts, and Thomas Jefferson's seal of approval on that as well. I've also read that the part of that deal in Massachusetts was basically, everyone knew that George Washington was going to be president, but there was some concern, there was some worry that Virginia was not going to ratify and they were going to be an independent nation like Rhode Island and North Carolina were for some time. And so there was concern that, well, Washington could then not be president. So I think from my understanding, at least how I've read into this, is that the deal was made that also included, well, if that happens, John Hancock, you're probably going to be the guy. And even on top of that, after Virginia ratified, it was very likely that John Hancock, who was also nominated to be president and only got a handful of votes, but he was very ill and he died very young, I think at like 56 years old. But it's very possible, because they wanted to balance the Virginia and Massachusetts kind of factions, we'll call them, it was George Washington and John Adams. But it may well have been, if Hancock was not ill, it may have been George Washington and John Hancock. But that's probably a discussion for another timeline. And I'm wonder what would have happened if he hadn't fallen so ill, and then he was the VP, and then instead of John Adams and the Alien Sedition Acts, maybe it was John Hancock who was so on board with a division of federal and state power. But it's also a lesson. It's a reminder of what Patrick Henry and so many others told us, that if you rely on the goodness of a single person to do the right thing, you will always lose your liberty. And I think that's basically how things have played out. Anyways, this is the kind of essential kind of history that we want to share. Of course, as
John Hancock himself said, let me pull this one up here because I think this is a great summation. He said, surely you never will tamely suffer this country to be a den of thieves. Remember, my friends, from whom you sprang. And we're trying to take that advice to heart here today. It already is a den of thieves, unfortunately, but we are trying to remind the people from whom we all sprang. This is the kind of information we work hard every day to get out to more people. This is not always our normal kind of episode of Path to Liberty, but I thought this was interesting. One of my favorite founders and old revolutionaries. If you want to help us spread this kind of message, help us take a stand for the Constitution and liberty, whether the government wants us to or not, which is not an easy thing. We need some financial support, and nothing helps us get that job done more than the financial faith and support of our members. You can join us for as little as $2 a month over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. I see a bunch of comments back and forth. Sharon Domo, Cowboy Clay, and a few others. I'll have to take some time, since I went a little bit longer than I expected to today, I'll have to take some time and read through those comments later today or tomorrow, so please continue doing that. Again, support us at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members for as little as $2 a month, you can also smash the like button, leave reviews on all the podcast platforms, share links, comments in the archive. All that helps out a great deal. I really appreciate you being here. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed sharing this information with you. I hope you had a great weekend. Your Monday's off to a good start, and I'll see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.